It's Sunday, which means it's time for Viewpoint Presents with Malcolm and Michael Johns. Each week, we bring you the top global and national news stories presented with facts and top-tier analysis, all from a perspective rooted in America's founding principles. Join us in defending our great nation and American liberty. Now, here's Malcolm and Michael with the week's top stories.
Well, I've referenced this entire spectacle as the darkness before the light, because as you all know out there, typically before the morning dawn arises and the sun, that beautiful sun is there, it is darkness. And many would say that is what the DNC delivered in their convention. And then what do you think about some of the questions that you'd like to ask a Joe Biden or a Kamala Harris that have not been asked? Many examples of that, as well as what's happening to our cities. And then I think this powerful conversation we're going to have on the corporate sponsorships and the funding for the Black Lives Matter, these radical Marxist movements and groups. And this gets really interesting. It goes back quite a few years, actually. So welcome again to Viewpoint Presents. It is Malcolm here, along with Michael Johns. You know, there was no mention about what's happening in America's cities. But, you know, when I think about darkness and you see the violence happening in Portland, which has been going on now for a couple of months, isn't that darkness is the question? And then you see what's happening in Chicago with Mayor Lori Lightfoot, saying that she's lost control of the city and was deploying police to protect her own block. That's another point of darkness reference, Michael. And, you know, let me just, Michael, as I go to you here, read you this one quote here from the mayor of Chicago. And it's hard to fathom that a mayor really has the audacity to say this. The Chicago mayor says, "I have an obligation to keep my home, my wife and my 12-year-old and my neighbors safe. The deployments that are there when they are necessary. It's not a 24-hour thing, and I think that the residents of the city, understanding the nature of the threats that we are receiving on a daily basis, understand that I have a right to make sure that my home is secure." I have to tell you, that quote and phrase from that mayor caught me by surprise, Michael, because isn't that what every resident of every city deserves? But yet, isn't that darkness?
Yeah, this is a common theme of contemporary liberalism, one standard for me and another for thee. So that when it comes to their own protection, they're all about the Second Amendment. They're all about cracking down on keeping protesters at bay. I recall when Obama built his D.C. home, one of the first things he did was put up a big wall around it. Apparently no sense of understanding of the obvious hypocrisy and irony in those developments. And so they're very keen on their own security and simultaneously and disastrously very oblivious to the security of the people they ostensibly represented and represent.
Yeah, it's kind of this attitude of hooray for me and the hell with you. I mean, that's what I get out of a lot of these politicians and these Marxist mayors that seem to be multiplying these days in our cities. But let's talk about the darkness now, because the DNC puts this mega virtual convention on. So what I got out of it in reading a lot of the transcripts and the excerpts coming, the videos coming from this, because I certainly could not buck it up. I wouldn't imagine. I don't know if you watched every night. I couldn't do it, Michael. There's no way I can do it. But I want to be informed to be able to tell our listeners what's going on and through my daily show. And so, of course, I did that, as you know, and reported on it. But at the same time, it was a very dark, dark vision of America they seem to have. But, you know, and their whole message seemed to be very dark, but yet they really didn't talk about the problems. There was no mention whatsoever about what's happening with the civil unrest. It never came up in their entire convention.
Yeah, I just think it's, you watch it, and I think if you've been glued into American politics for, let's just say 20 years or longer, like if you're at least middle-aged, and you've been following things, you can't help but notice just this unbelievable, I think you labeled it right, this kind of darkness that has overcome this entire party, where they will lie, they will call names, they will make false allegations, they will not address the content of their own platforms, they will deceive. And then they'll close it all up with saying it's time to end the division in American politics after they've poured the gasoline all over the flames that they themselves created. This has been the ongoing theme. I mean, I suppose the highlight of the convention was probably Michelle Obama there at the beginning. And she's, I think, maybe one of the most obvious offenders in this genre of politics of, you know, they go low, we go high. But, you know, she's always been the one going low. And there she was again, basically really attacking the character, the demeanor, and diminishing, underplaying, not acknowledging the extraordinary accomplishments that President Trump has had since coming to office in 17.
And when they put a message like that out to the American people and say, you know, let's all go high, 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 and not too low, but yet they do everything about their message and what they're doing to our great cities and the way they run their politics is extremely low. And then you have to wonder the disconnect and who's really paying attention to this. You know, what I always wonder with these kinds of narratives that you and I talk about is, does this resonate with the American people? I mean, and no. I don't really know sometimes. You don't think it does?
No. So look, a few metrics here that I think are, that, you know, to kind of just take this away from my own view and try to put it on a little level of objectivity. Number one, the viewership for the whole week was substantially lower than it was in 16. You might attribute some of that to the pandemic and the fact that they didn't have the crowds, which made it a little less interesting. But that's offset by the fact that you have a lot more people at home than you usually would. And there's been a lot of programming, including news programming that are hitting all-time your viewership records.
It was about 20% off the mark, I want to tell you, what I understand from the numbers. 20% less this time than 2016 is what I gathered. That's a lot.
Right. Yeah, it's really substantial. And then you get into the fact that Rasmussen poll that you and I have cited a few times now, which is the only polling agency now doing daily polling on the president's popularity, had the president up at 50% again at the end of the week, where he's been kind of varying in that 47 to 50 range. So objectively, if you asked, did President Trump sustain any political damage on, you know, consecutive nights of primetime attacks on him from every angle, from the best the Democrat Party has to offer in 2020, the answer is no. No damage was done to this president. And I think things are lined up now really perfectly for him to be able to provide a more objective, substance-based, relatable, and optimistic vision for the future of the country and the Republican convention this coming week.
It's going to be interesting. I'm really looking forward to reporting on the RNC. I mean, I'm excited about this next week, I have to tell you. And compared to, it was very challenging for me as a patriot to report on the DNC and all this darkness, Michael, we're talking about. But I'm really juiced about next week. And you and I need to talk more about this next week and what things we can do about that. But, you know, you just mentioned the daily presidential track and poll with Rasmussen. It's the only, again, track and poll that does this on a daily basis. And let me just say to you, the good news, Michael, is that when it closed late Friday, it only reports Monday through Friday, by the way, but when it were reported, it was 51%, by the way. Okay. So that's a beautiful thing, right? I mean, that's a beautiful thing. So
well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, that's, we haven't, well, you know, by the way, these are the same ranges Obama was in when he was, reelected in 2012. So if you're looking for any degree of optimism in these numbers, you can find it there. And you can find it in a lot of other metrics like the enthusiasm gap that we've talked about. And new polling now that's showing that, you know, really roughly high 30% of those who intend to vote for Biden are voting for him because they want to vote for Biden. Their votes against Trump. And some reporting I saw this past week in Town Hall showed that no president since 84 has ever no candidate has ever been elected since 1984 with numbers under 50%. And Biden is in, I think, like the 37, 38 range right now in that.
There you go. Yeah. Well, listen, if you compare and contrast the two worlds that they painted out all week long at the DNC, and I'm speaking of the world of darkness and the world of light, okay? And you take a look at the current issues we're dealing with right now, okay, all over the country, and then you see their message that they put out in the premise that they put out there. How can you not see, where's the question American people need to ask themselves right now? Where's this darkness coming from? I mean, their policies in the DNC right now, he's even talking about another lockdown if necessary. Mm-hmm. He's happy to do it, Joe Biden says. Not a problem for him at all. Doesn't care about anything else, but he's happy to do it, to lock everything down. They've got, everything that's happening in America's cities, the civil unrest and the politicization of all of that and the politicizing of the pandemic. So talk to me. Where does all the darkness come from right now? You hear the president the other day, and he's an optimist. He's talking about, cheerleader for the American public and patriotism. So where's the darkness coming from?
Here's where it comes from. I think a month ago or 2 months ago, you sit down, you're part of the planning for the Democrat convention. And somebody says, all right, let's pull out our major points on our platform and talk about how we're going to present these to the American people. And someone runs, gets the most recent platform, says, okay, we're going to raise taxes $4 trillion on 80% of the American people. How do we want to present that one? And they all look around the table and everybody's shaking their head, doesn't have an answer to it. They decide to ignore it. They say, okay, border policy and illegal immigration. We have nothing. We got zero, apparently. It's come one, come all into the United States of America. And not only that, but we'll offer you health benefits and other welfare benefits. How do we present that one to the American people? Don't know. No one's got an answer. We're going to more or less undermine law enforcement, disparage them in public, probably encourage communities to begin cutting some of this funding. How do we present that? That's not a winner. Can't do that one. Green New Deal, 10 million new energy jobs, 10 million energy jobs go away. How are we going to present that one? They have no answer to that. And then you get to even to the coronavirus and you say, Trump put the travel ban in January 31. Biden called it racist and xenophobic, and we still don't know the date on if ever he would have put a travel ban in on the infected individuals in China. How do we present that to the American people? Let's just attack him anyway. You know, let's just go after it. We'll say he's mismanaged it and be vague about it. And when I got through watching this very closely, both through a pro-Trump lens, but also through an objective professional lens as someone who's crafted messaging for a president of the United States, yeah, I concluded that there was no specificity offered at all on their agenda for the future of this country. There were cliches, there was ugliness, and there was name-calling. That was the essence of what they had to offer. That was the best of what they had to offer, by really highly compensated professional message managers, because the substance isn't there. And then here's the other thing I noticed that was not mentioned very much, and that was the name Joe Biden. Really, I'd like to see some reporting on how many times Trump's name was mentioned versus Biden, because you can tell there is immense trepidation about this man as an individual, his current capabilities mentally and physically for the job, and 47 years of absolutely unremarkable track record at the highest levels of government. And, you know, typically when you think of these conventions, and if you've watched them, Republican or Democrat, when you put forward your presidential nominee, you're going to take the highlights of that individual's accomplishments in the political and public policy sphere and maybe in other spheres and put them out there before the American people, saying, look, he or she did all of these things. Look what they can do if you give them 4 years. And there really was no presentation along those lines with Biden either, because in 47 years, even the most passionate Biden supporters, who are usually paid Democrat operatives, cannot articulate anything of substance that this man has done in 47 years that has made the country even a little bit different. Yeah. And he's been all over the map on any of these issues, which is both a plus and a minus. On one hand, he's the quintessential flip-flopper. On the other, I suppose if you want to present him as progressive, you can pull a few things out. If you want to present him as not progressive, you can pull a few things out. I just don't think that he's inspiring anyone.
Well, the cliches that you're speaking about there, these cliches, there was a point where they were talking, and I was listening to the things, the rhetoric that they were putting out there. And I said to myself, my golly, I've heard all of this before. This could have been a speech in 2016, could have been a speech in 2012, could have been a speech. It's the same, but none of this stuff has ever been fixed, which plays to the point of what you just say. The man has been in the political system near and now 50 years. All of a sudden, he wakes up and says, oh, my God, I can fix things now all of a sudden. When he's in his senior years and he's losing his mind, he now seems to think, or his handlers say.
Well, and that's not there either, Malcolm. Yeah. That's just not there. Right. I mean, I've read every word of the Democrat, of his website platform.
Right. Right.
And I'm telling you that when you dive into this stuff and you read it, it is incredibly vague. It talks about these vague objectives, but then you match them with what they actually want to do, and they don't match up. Yeah. I mean, there is no plan for job creation.
Well, they're cliches again.
There is no plan to lower energy costs. No. There is no plan to deal with illegal immigration. There is no plan to stand up to China or Iran or the few major national security threats we have in this country. There is no sophisticated national security or defense policy plan. No plan on wages. I mean, no plan on health care, really. I mean, when you really drill down to what he's going to do, he has no plan on healthcare, except to the extent that you know those policies are going to undermine the private sector, undermine employment, which are going to raise premiums, and fewer individuals are going to be employed to take advantage of those private plans, which is going to drive up demand for some sort of public system, which has always been the way they've cleverly gone about this. Which is to say cleverly as in deceptively.
That's right. Well, there they do have a plan, though, to raise taxes. That is planned
out. Yes, $4 trillion. Yeah. $4 trillion of tax increases on 80% of the country. All those tax, the 82% of middle-income workers who experienced tax relief under Trump, gone. He's going to completely repeal that and raise the taxes on.
See, this is what America needs to pay attention to. Back to the empty cliches, which, again, you could just run the tape from previous elections, and you're right, there are no concrete plans there to do any of it. And the reason is, Michael, is because these things have failed before. They have never been successful with their policies. And I'm talking about the Democrat socialist movement. And so clearly, you can't present a plan for something that's going to fail. So then what you do is you use the cliche. The one thing they do have, which Newt Gingrich points out, by the way, really well, is they have effective speechwriters, if you like that sort of thing. Now, I was not engaged with his speech, speaking about Joe Biden. I found him a very angry old man, really yelling at times.
He is angry. I'm glad you observed that. Not many people have made that observation, Malcolm. I will tell you, but I will say, if you go back and you look throughout all of these town halls in all of his presidential races,
he's always been angry.
He's all smiles until he's confronted with facts or with anything that doesn't jive with his message.
That's right. That's right.
Then it turns to anger.
That's what I'm saying right there.
And name calling.
No, you're right.
He is incredibly defensive.
Anytime he's put on the spot for truth, he gets angry. You've seen him with reporters. You've seen how he interacts, Michael. He gets vicious. He gets cruel.
He is, and it always comes, everything around him has got to be, what he wants to hear at the moment he wants to hear it. And all of these examples of him blowing his gasket with all of these phrases that have been repeated over and over again, that he said, happens routinely when he's confronted with the reality of a track record that is unremarkable.
Yeah.
I think ultimately we're dealing with a campaign and a candidate who are aware of two fundamental facts, and they're both disturbing. Number one, most importantly, is that the candidate himself is not up to the job, right? No, anyone observing it notices it and has remarked on it. And it was apparent in the early primaries that he wasn't resonating with voters in those smaller states where he had to interact with them individually. And another Rasmussen poll on his preparedness for the job, 59%, almost 6 out of 10 Americans believe he cannot finish. He does not have the physical or mental capacity to finish a 4-year term. That's hugely important. And then number two is that a majority, over 50%, believe Kamala Harris is not qualified to be president of the United States.
Yeah, and I think the vast majority of Americans would agree with everything you just said. There is no preparation beyond what we're seeing. The smoke and mirrors campaign is what we're looking at, what we're thinking. But if you do the math with everything you just said and you realize that, again, most Americans believe he is unable to finish, unable to do these things, and I think most people would see that, then you begin to realize why they have kept Biden out of the range of the media, which we all understand why. And now the media is trying to act tough, like, well, we're going to have to really see the real Joe now. You know, we're going to have to really, and you know, they give him a pass consistently, but yet now I hear some trying to say he's going to have to get out there now. And so, you know, we'll see what we see in the next few weeks as supposedly the debates happen and all that. But listen, in a moment too, I want to share with you, as I started to in the next moment, we'll talk about some of the questions that Biden and Harris really should be asked, should be required to answer for sure. But also, I mentioned Newt Gingrich, very interesting when we talk about this light and darkness and the smoke and mirrors campaign that has been put out there. And, you know, Americans have to ask themselves, where's this darkness coming from? You know, this sort of vision of America, this horribly dystopian sort of look of a vision of what they see for America, which is, you know, again, point in case, people, the crime and the violence and the vandalism and all that is happening in our cities and towns across our great country. It gets interesting. There's some other things to share with Michael. We're going to take a quick pause and we'll be back with much more of the Premier News Magazine just after this pause.
We are the vision of the voices. You can email us at talk@americaoutloud.com.
Spreading the out loud truth from sea to shining sea. AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world. To unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. We are the vision of the voices. Welcome to the new era in communications. America Out Loud Talk Radio.
American Democracy in Action. Viewpoint presents Election 2020.
Michael, I started to tell you about Newt Gingrich, and there was an interesting op-ed he had in Newsweek, which he put it in perspective. And he said, Vice President Joe Biden delivered the best speech of his career. Many of them said that. He said it was so well written, it could have been done by the speechwriters for Bill Clinton or Barack Obama. They are the best orators in the modern Democrat Party. And the tone, pacing, and word choices of Biden's speech were worthy of their better performances. He said Biden did not seem to have plagiarized any of his speech, which is a step up from his past performances. And Biden delivered the speech well, with the right emotions at key points and the right forcefulness at other moments. Now, I don't agree with the speaker was being a little bit sarcastic there, but I don't necessarily agree with his assessment of the speech itself. I found it very angry, very disconnected, a very dark, dystopian look of America. So what is it that I was listening to where others like this were listening to? What are your thoughts?
I had the same observation, Malcolm. I just did not feel that he did much with that speech. And I think part of the problem goes back to what I was saying earlier, is that he didn't have much to work with. So when you go into one of those speeches, and obviously you have the best speechwriters in the world available to you, so turning a phrase is not the challenge. But as a former presidential speechwriter, one thing that's you can't do, the limitation of the job, you cannot revise history and the facts of what a candidate has or has not accomplished. And as I said, this is a very unremarkable and extraordinarily long swamp-like career that this man has had. So there wasn't much he could point to in the way of saying, you know, because of my leadership, because of the people of Delaware, because of Barack Obama selected me as vice president, I did A, B, and C. Those weren't there. And then you look at the actual agenda for the American people, and it's a one that I suppose is pleasing to the far left, who you know, just seem to be less and less invested in America's success or even survival. And he can't talk to them, and he can't really get into the core of these details, because what it means is fewer jobs, lower wages, slower growth, more globalization, more offshoring of both our functional national responsibility and of our industries and jobs. Nothing really in there that really grabs the attention of the American people. And the one thing that at least Obama had going for him in 08, which of course he betrayed the American people on, in my view, I think in the view of most Americans, was healthcare. There was this perception back in 08, somehow Democrats did have some secret plan to resolve skyrocketing healthcare prices and the uninsured, which were in the, and still are in the tens of millions of Americans. But, you know, they put that plan in place. They had to literally force the uninsured to enroll in it at the, you know, or to pay a penalty. Once Trump got rid of the mandate, many people dropped out of the plan because they weren't in it for the health insurance, the premiums of which were extraordinarily high, and the cost of which, the co-payments of which were extraordinarily high. It was really almost like a catastrophic healthcare plan. It didn't add much to the lives of most Americans. And I think Biden has to basically live with the 8-year unremarkable track record of Obama, who did very little in the way of job creation, with the lowest labor participation, you know, in since the 70s. Millions of Americans not in the labor force, lowest home ownership in 51 years, 11 million more Americans were on food stamps when Obama and Biden left office than they were before they arrived, 43 million more were at the poverty level. The national debt, widely advertised, doubled on his watch. You know, nearly $1 trillion worth of new business regulations, 300,000 manufacturing jobs lost, global trade deficit that rose to over $700 billion. What metric would you conceivably or possibly point to in 8 years, not 4 years, 8 years mm-hmm. of their stewardship of this country and say, well, at least they fixed that issue? Every single metric points in the red. Every single step that they took, which weren't many, betrayed the promises, the grand promises that they made in 2008 to address these issues. And the poor in this country were poorer after the 8 years than they were before they arrived. And the middle class, the forgotten man and woman, suffered immensely. I will give them this. The rich got richer on Obama and Biden's watch. That's a demonstrable fact.
Yeah, which they never admit. But when you really think about this past 6, 8, 10 months and understand that Joe Biden has gotten a complete pass from all of the media, not only have they given him a pass, but they have, the Biden campaign has been successful in keeping their client, their candidate, under cover. They've hidden him beyond the media lights and cameras and microphones very clearly. And here's the thing. So when you think about the kinds of things you just mentioned, these real policies, and then let's think about the kinds of questions that really should be asked to a Joe Biden or a Kamala Harris. And really, a couple of the first top questions that come to my mind, Michael, are this. All right, you know, Mr. Vice President, you want to be the president here of the United States. So, all right, so the one that you always mention about the travel, and you're so right to say, you know, let's call him on that. If, you know, you're talking about another lockdown and doing some extreme measures in our nation, wouldn't one of the other extreme measures you need to be to do would be to limit travel internationally? If you're that concerned with the pandemic, doing another, the next round of pandemic hits and more people dying, I mean, should that be a consideration, Mr. Vice President? Mr. Vice President, since you're going to raise taxes on the vast majority of Americans, and when they've already been hit from a pandemic and already struggling to make ends meet, and families and middle-class families and small business, let's not forget small business. they've been hit twice with a sucker punch to the face and the gut with the pandemic and the civil unrest in all the cities busting and breaking their businesses up. And many of these people will never come back again. They're out of business forever. I mean, but our business community has been hit so hard. I don't know how it comes back or when it comes back exactly. I mean, that's a major problem. So there's another question I would like an answer to. You know, what do you propose to do for that? And so these are the kinds of things, Michael. What are some of the questions you would ask the vice president?
Well, let's start with the present tense. Again, acknowledge that the country's confronting two crises right now, mm-hmm. the pandemic and the street violence. I think on the pandemic, he's trying to present himself as having some forward-looking secret plan to resolve this. Right. And yet when you go, we have the good fortune, however, of looking at what his rhetorical record has been since the pandemic's onset. And if you go back and look at it, he has trailed everything that Trump has done. He's, you know, President Trump has taken an initiative and then, like, you know, a matter of days or weeks go by and then Biden basically comes out and calls for something that's already been done, hoping the American people hadn't noticed it. It started with the travel ban, January 31. He very foolishly opposes it, calls it racist and xenophobic, then later sort of acknowledges that maybe it wasn't that bad of an idea, but never retracts his original statements about it. If you look at the Defense Production Act, the DPA, that the president correctly employed, literally the president put it in place, and then, like, within a matter of days, he came out and called for it to be utilized, like it was some novel idea. He had never mentioned once the Defense Production Act at any point during the pandemic, never had suggested that it maybe ought to even be looked at. And then when he does come out and issues his first statement on it, it's days after the president had already authorized utilization of it. Same thing on sending U.S. CDC and other clinical personnel to China. I mean, the president was trying to do that. If you go back and look at the record,
that's right. He was.
Into like, I think as far back as the end of December and then into early January. And
they
of course, Communist China wouldn't let them in. Of course, I was on China's global television earlier this week, and they seem to forget that fact or not be willing to acknowledge it. So that's another matter. But the point is that they would, you know, he came out, I think, in February and say we ought to be trying to send our experts into China. I'm sorry, the president's been trying to do that for 2 months. It's not a novel idea. And, yeah. You know, and then he's trying to say now that he had forewarned about the pandemic. He was oblivious to this pandemic, which I mentioned the travel ban because I think that's most reflective of the fact that even in the end of January, when it was becoming clear, I think just to everyday Americans that we had an issue here, maybe we didn't envision it being quite as bad as it's been. He was, you know, oblivious to it. And by the way, this is very consistent with this guy's record. Throughout this nearly five-decade career, he is not known for coming, for being, there are people who are known on the conservatives and on the left for being innovative policy thinkers. He is not an innovative policy thinker. He is a very smooth politician and has now seemingly even lost that attribute.
Yeah, absolutely.
I tend to look at him, and we never talked about this before, but I tend to look at him exactly like you do. I think there's an element of anger in there. Mm-hmm. I think he's incredibly nervous about the responsibilities and challenge that he confronts over the next 2 months. Mm-hmm. And if President Trump is focused on some of the deficiencies in his career and on the issues we confront, he should do well. Then I mentioned there were two issues. The second one is the street violence. Mm-hmm. And I guess the question there, Malcolm, is why have we not heard either – you know, they have two options. They could say, look, don't tear up the streets, don't burn down buildings, don't shoot at innocent civilians, please stop. That would be very constructive for the country to hear that out of Joe Biden's mouth. Why have we not heard that out of his mouth? Conversely, if he actually supports it for whatever bizarre reason, he would see it that way. If he does believe somehow this is constructive toward the country, why doesn't he come out and endorse it?
Well, they
participate
also,
in it.
They are doing
but it's gutless, it's spineless, which is indicative of the way he has led for a long time, which is that you know, all of his radical ideas are done in secret behind closed doors. None of them are out front. And that's what I've loved about President Trump from day one, is he said, we're going to go do these huge, big, bold things. That's something that's Kennedy-like. That's Reagan-like.
And he tells you what he's going to do.
You're not going to get any. You're not going to get any of that.
Yeah. So Trump doesn't
Other questions.
It.
I mean, you got to go through this, both his track record and the agenda. You got to say you're going to raise $4 trillion of taxes on American people. How is that going to create one job or raise the wage of one worker? It's going to achieve just the opposite. You have literally no plan to contain illegal immigration into this country. How many illegal immigrants would be a burden to you? Would it be 50 million, 60 million, 70 million? What point does it sort of become problematic to you? Obamacare was a classic failure. Why should we believe that somehow he's now, you know, got some grand design to address health care costs and coverage?
With Joe Biden, I think what Biden is doing, he's having an out-of-body experience. So when you say, well, he doesn't, you know, the one thing he used to have going for him back in the day, which he doesn't have anymore, that because he's lost a few steps and then some and doesn't have the charisma. Well, he doesn't. I mean, just watch him. But he doesn't have the answers because he has been there for almost those 50 years, as you've mentioned. He knows he's incapable of fixing any of these things. But he has to. He's the kind of person that he's got to almost pinch himself to realize that he's, you know, running for president of the United States. And yet he's in over his head. And he knows that. But yet he's been put to the test from his family, but more so from the Democrat Party and the operatives who've got him in this position. I've had a lot of people say to me, why would his wife do this to the man, which you and I have talked about before. And that is a good question. Why would Dr. Jill Biden do this? You know, she loves her husband, clearly.
Well, remember, he was slow to get into it, Malcolm.
He was. He was.
So it was. It, you know, like you see people that are, you know, jumping at it, they can't get at it fast enough. Exploratory committee years in advance. And you see, and you know, the other thing is just from a demeanor standpoint, which you're addressing, is you see candidates on the campaign trail. I would cite Obama in 08, I would cite Trump in 16, Reagan in 80, who not just are persuasive and appealing to the people, but seem to be enjoying the experience. Right, they seem to be enjoying connecting with the American people, hearing out the issues and offering solutions and building momentum for the candidacy. Sure. I don't sense any of that in Joe Biden. This seems like an extraordinary burden that he wishes he weren't encumbered by.
Well, the biggest reason why they avoided, everybody's asking and wondering, as you just did a moment ago, why did they not address any of the unrest and all of the vandalism, but at least come out and say something? You're pro it, you're for it, you're against it. But you see, the reason they've avoided it all, they've, like, it never happened. I mean, if you looked at their whole utopian view of the nation and what they thought it was going to be and the darkness and the picture they painted, which they are, in fact, responsible for creating this darkness, and yet they avoided the main subject matter entirely, never once brought it up, never once had a solution or an idea. And the reason for that, Michael, is this, because these are the people. These are the perpetrators. These are the ones who want to defund the police officer. They want to abolish in some cases. They know, they recognize, they understand that the Democrat cities that are falling apart at every hour that passes by, that they are managed by their constituency, by their colleagues, rather, their other people within their group, their organization of these are Democrats. These are their people. They're not independents. They're not Republicans. They're not anything. They're Democrats. And they're responsible for all that. So how are they? So if they would have bought it up, do you realize how uncomfortable that would be if they bought it up? They say, well, because they don't have any answers. And when you say, do they support it? Yes, they support it. They support Black Lives Matter. They support Antifa. They support the vandalism. They support the criminality factor. They created the damn thing.
Yeah, they do support it until November 4th. Then they'll oppose it, I suppose. And that's kind of gets
the issue. I'm not sure about that.
Well, they're not. They will embrace the agenda, but they're not going to embrace. I don't know about the rest of it. I think you basically they want to be all things to all people, and in so doing, they're nothing to anyone. If I were on the left, I would say, hold on a second. I'm supposed to be enthusiastic about these guys. No Medicare for all. a diluted kind of Green New Deal, and no embrace really of the cuts in law enforcement funding. They obviously went out, did polling on that, saw it was a hugely politically unpopular agenda item, and said, we'll do it, but we're not going to be bold about it. And that's the key about this plan. You're exactly right. They are incredibly radical. They do want single payer healthcare. They do want a vast decimation of energy in this country as we know it. They do want a country filled with illegal immigrants. Mm-hmm. They think that's actually a positive thing.
Right.
They do want to tax Americans to a point where welfare dependency in this country actually increases. They want that to them as their political right. constituency and how they keep power. But they know that they can't get into office talking about that agenda. So it's, you get what you had the last 4 days, which is incredible vagueness and just calling the current president all sorts of names. In retrospect, it really was an incredibly childlike convention. With yeah. no solutions to any of the issues. You know, if they'd come up and really said, you know, when you're taught like debate or argument or even persuasive writing, one of the first things you're taught is to concede the obvious points.
Mm-hmm.
Because in not conceding them, you allow the opponent
right.
to kind of
That's
focus
right.
on them.
Mm-hmm.
If they had gotten in there and said, you know, Trump did a few things over the first 3 years that were helpful. You know, if they had sort of acknowledged some of the extraordinary accomplishments, mm-hmm. they could have moved on to some issues that were more centered to them. But in not doing that, they just come across as give us the power because we want it.
Right.
And if you're not going to, you know, it really is, it's like extortion almost.
Yeah, well, no, it is, because they know they can't, because then Biden would have to follow that up with some real policies or some real ideas. So they're better off to ignore and be vague, which is really their strategy. I mean, this is what they came up with when they met prior and they put this whole campaign together. And they realized that it was going to be Joe Biden they were left with, which, by the way, is also another crazy idea, that you had all these contestants, these political contestants, in their game show of who would be the Democrat, pin the tail on the donkey, point being donkey being Democrat, being, you know, that model, that icon. You know, you think about all of that, and then they ended up with Joe Biden, because that's the best. Here's the thing that should not be lost. That's the best that party could do. And
what was the one theme that did get through, Malcolm?
Yeah.
They kept mentioning decency. Yeah. All right. But let's be honest. Mm. A candidate who in 2012 said that Romney was going to put African Americans back in chains, a candidate who leveraged his positional authority to enrich his son on Burisma and China, a candidate who has had nothing but disparaging terms to describe the duly elected president of the United States for a year now. There's been nothing decent about this campaign.
Right.
They've
right.
been indecent. And I find that, again, just another subject-changing description to throw out there so they don't have to talk about their inability to address these issues.
We're going to take a pause here, a moment here. We're going to take a pause, but leave this last thought with you all to be thinking about here, and that is this. The model of the socialist, Democrat, Marxist party of America is that, well, we are the people who can create the crisis. And if we create the crisis, you'll realize that we have to fix it. And therefore, you'll keep us in power to fix the crisis. That is the oldest play in the book that comes from the oldest Marxist in the whole Alinsky strategy. And my fellow Americans, that is exactly front and center here in this campaign with this hostile, negative Democrat, socialist, Marxist party. And that's what you got here. So when we say, why don't they have that? Well, because they don't want to fix the problem. And when they get, if they were ever to get into power, that would still go on. And the decline of the great American cities is going to continue, because I'm telling you now, people, I'm pleading with you to understand, not only do they not have the answers, they don't want to fix the problem. This is how they engage themselves. It's how they is instill in power. It's their way to be needed. It is the oldest Marxist strategy in the book. More Viewpoint in just a moment.
The The America Out Loud Talk Radio app is on Android or Apple. It's the perfect way to listen in to the new generation of talk shows and hosts who are ready to inform and inspire.
Did you know the average person spends 26 years of their life sleeping? The real troubling statistic is that we spend 7 years of our life trying to get to sleep, struggling with racing minds, tossing and turning. If you're one of the millions of Americans who need better quality sleep, the time to change is now. Sleep is proven to extend our lifespan, protect against terrible diseases like cancer, heart disease, and dementia, make us more attractive and thinner, feel calmer and happier, and boost energy levels, memory, and performance. Until now, most sleep supplements haven't worked, but a new, easy-to-swallow sleep gel, invented by the leading nutrition company, Healthy Cell, is designed to support all four stages of human sleep to help you fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deep, and wake up refreshed. It's called REM Sleep. To get a free two-night supply of REM sleep, visit healthycell.com/sleep. That's healthy, CELL.com/sleep.
Join you back here on Viewpoint Presents. And okay, so I've got one. We want to talk about the funding, corporate sponsorships for the Marxists and all of that. But Michael, I got something to throw you right out of the gate here. And I want you to think about this a moment. But I received a message in yesterday from a journalist and a colleague out of Europe that I had not heard from in some time. Really great person. Informed on the issues. And this was the message they sent me. And this is probably what a lot of people are thinking around the world. And it's this: the world situation is insane, Malcolm, and I believe civil war could break out in the U.S. very soon. In the United States, I see a similar situation, which very much reminds me of the early stages of the revolution in Russia. And I'm alarmed. The United States could turn Marxist. You gotta fight! Exclamation mark, exclamation mark, exclamation mark. Now, this is a journalist and a colleague, well-respected, and somebody who never talks that way. It never does. I mean, so this message was to say to me, hey, I know you're doing some great work there, but you know, we really think you're in a whole heap of trouble here. What do you get out of that that phrase and that quote and that message I received in? We're talking, now we're going to talk about Marxists here.
Well, firstly, if you spend any time in Europe or Asia, Latin America, and you're kind of like trying to glue into the news when you're in these regions and you're tuning in into, you know, kind of BBC Worldwide, or you're tuning into CNN International, if you think you're getting like a lot of bias out of the U.S. media, you get even, you know, more negative presentations abroad. So obviously these riots have played out all over the world, and they played out without any explanation of the restraints of federalism that exist on the president's inability to curtail them. So you're looking at these riots and, you know, you're in Sweden or something, you're sort of asking yourself, well, Trump's a strong president. He doesn't support this sort of thing. Why isn't he going in and stopping it? Well, the answer, of course, is that the authority for law enforcement in that area typically falls to those cities who are not in turn enforcing the law. So it looks really bad. But the reality of the predicament that your colleague there describes is a real one. You know, we would be foolish and self-destructive not to acknowledge the possibility that the inevitable ascent and continuation of our constitutional republic is in grave danger. It's been in grave danger. And the institutions that have been undermining it and committing to even toppling it are more powerful than ever. There is lots of money on that side. There is communist China that wants to see it happen and is engaged in active measures trying to make it happen. There are street gangs that have been paid and otherwise incentivized to create a sense of chaos. We have an educational system that's completely abandoned objective presentations of the greatness of our country or the history of it. We have an entire generation that has been taught almost nothing objectively about the extraordinary accomplishments of this country's founding. And we have an economic condition at home that, you know, I have always believed the middle class is the key to this country succeeding, and it cannot survive with only two classes, an elite wealthy and the rest being dependent on the welfare state. And that was the way it was moving under Obama and Biden, aggressively in that direction, and they were fine with that. And this President Trump, you know, when he came out and talked about the forgotten man and woman, implicitly in that, I believe he realized that this fact is true, that the middle class needs to survive for the country to survive. And he's done a decent job despite all this opposition. But, you know, should he lose, and particularly should Congress go as well,
where are the restraints? I mean, we have our Constitution, but we're still dealing with activist courts to routinely ignore it. A lot of people come back and go, "Oh, we still have our Second Amendment rights."
Joe Biden was asked on Anderson Cooper about that, said, you know, some of your opponents say that your gun position is so aggressive that you're going to be coming for the guns, the American people. And if you saw that, or you recall Biden's response, it was bingo. He didn't do anything to discourage the perception during the primary that he actually does intend to do that.
Yeah.
The people of this country remain generally and largely very decent. They also have good instincts. That is something that the enemies of this country still realize, which is why they put so much effort in trying to disparage people who are speaking truth and speaking objectively about the predicament of this country. Okay. And they're continuing to do it. Is the country on the line? Yes, the country is on the line. How many exclamation points? He had 4. I'll put 5 on there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's talk about the Marxist move on America now, specifically Black Lives Matter. But there's a whole lot of Marxists in move here, and all of these radical groups would fall under that umbrella. There was an interesting article, Michael, back in 2015, November, in fact, on Politico, and it was entitled "Major Donors Consider Funding Black Lives Matter." Now, this was 2015, prior to Trump, and I want to point this out to you. And let me read this here. This is right out of the Politico article here, because a lot's happened since 2015 now, and they were just waiting for the Floyd opportunity anywhere. Floyd could have been anything, could have been absolutely anything, but these people have been waiting. They have been biting at the bit, and they have been part of the overarching strategy to pull down American cities. I am very convinced here there is a master plan to pull this nation down into a Marxist move. I am not a conspiracy guy. I never have been in my life. I deal with real facts and data, always have been. But I am convinced now more than ever in my life that this fight of good and evil is really upon us right now. Let me read this to you out of this Politico. "The movement needs cash to build a self-sustaining infrastructure," Phillips said, arguing, "Well, the progressive donor world should be adding zeros to their contributions that support this transformative movement." Emphasis, people, on transformative movement. But he also acknowledged there's a risk for recipient groups. Tactics such as shutting down freeways and disrupting rallies can alienate major donors. And if that's your primary source of support, then you're at risk of being blocked from doing what you need to do. The Democracy Alliance was created in 2005. A handful of major donors, including billionaire financier George Soros and Taco Bell's heir Rob McKay, to build a permanent infrastructure to advance liberal ideas and causes, Marxist ideas, what they're saying. Donors are required to donate at least $200,000 a year to recommended groups, and their combined donations to these groups now, get a load of this, Michael, total more than $500 million.
Yeah, I was doing the back of the envelope math. I was going to put a little short of that, but up in that direction. These are just Black Lives Matter donations that I'm aware of. Amazon, $10 million. Microsoft, Nabisco, $500,000. Gatorade, $500,000. Airbnb, $500,000, DoorDash, $500,000, Deckers, I think that's a clothing company, half a million, Glosser, it's a makeup company, half a million, 23andMe, put money in, Unilever, the hygiene company, 350 grand, Banji, Dropbox, half a million, Fitbit, the health fitness tracking company. This is incredible to me. Skillshoe online learning, Square Enix, 250 grand, Tinder, the online dating thing. I mean, these aren't individual donations by employees of these companies. These are corporate donations. And it's very frightening. I mean, when we founded our Tea Party movement, we also needed a lot of financial support. I never thought ever that there would be a possibility that a publicly traded company, even though they would be beneficiaries of our policies of lower taxes, et cetera, would take a stand of that nature. Here is an organization that arguably is engaged in, you know, you would almost call it domestic terrorism, right?
Nefarious activities.
Yeah, I, you know, you get into technicalities on the definition of that, but I mean, clearly the tactics are violent. Then they acknowledge it. I'm not even aware of, you know, so it's extortion and violence, basically, and threats. And yet you look at the amount of damage that's been done. This is going to be far and away the most damaging acts of violence, city violence in this country's history, probably $1 billion plus.
All right, so now, I got to ask you this. Why are these major companies, why are all of these people in these outlets, and with what I just read you, that started back in 2015, which shows there's a master plan here. Why are they wanting to fund this Marxist move and the destruction that's happening in great American cities? What's the answer?
I think it's more fear than ideology. I think it's more a fear of boycotts and of negative depictions and erosion to their brand by an aggressive group of individuals who know how to tear down things. That's what they're good at. They're not good at building things up. They're good at tearing them down. So, you know, if you go in and you tell Amazon, I want $10 million and they laugh at you, you say, okay, we'll go launch a boycott, national boycott on your brand and tell people not to buy it. And the impact on that is $15 million, it becomes a no-brainer financial decision.
So the left
and then,
does
and
that.
Then I suppose
you're yeah, saying, but the right doesn't do that well. The right doesn't do that with all the companies that come after them.
We don't. It's not an established tactic. It's actually technically illegal. It's actually technically illegal. Isn't that where Avante, isn't that attorney facing charges on exactly that with Nike? I mean, you're not allowed to go in and say, give money,
you can't do
else.
It. That's right. Yeah, Michael Avenatti.
But I think the threat's implicit. Yeah. I think the threat's implicit.
Well, it is, but it's all being done, and the right doesn't do it at all. But yet the left. There's something else here, Michael. I want to further this with you. This whole thing about we'll leave people in suspense of this because Michael and I will return to this topic. I think there's more to this story. I really believe it. And as you nail it all out with BLM and the Marxist move, and then all these companies and corporations, which Michael is so correct to point out, and the dollars behind it. And then you look back to 2015 and the message I put out there with you, my fellow Americans, it should all leave you with pause and to really understand something else is happening here. We'll stay on it here. Big, exciting week coming up here. Catch me on the Voice of a Nation all week long at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, or again at 10 there. And we'll continue on with the movement here. We need your help to get involved, get the message out there. Let's do our part, my fellow Americans. It's time to get involved and get loud.